Hello. Okay, thanks for having me first. Now I've done the drawing like 6 days ago to this poem, so I'm going to hand it around. But what I'm going to explain is that it's about the poem's called The Autumn God, and like coincidentally, a few days ago it was the beginning of the pagan autumn. So if you want to hand up.
Yeah.
Okay, brilliant. You're going to hand it up for me. I'm going to keep warm. There's about nine from there. So I got my friend to model this picture for me, and she was actually born in autumn as well, and she had a dream about being an autumn god. But I wrote the poem in November last year. Now, like, the poem at the top has the picture. I'll just talk about the picture first. It has, there's branches at the top, but there's actually like, there's two branches that become demons in there. There's Ludo from Labyrinth, because I think he should be in, like, the sort of scene. There's like dark eyes in the corner around the left-hand side. The baby, the changeling in her arms, is actually a portrait of her own child, but with more demon eyes and a tail, which she totally didn't mind me drawing. There's a fox. There's an eagle owl on the right-hand side. There's a heron with a hair in its mouth, in its beak. And there's a badger, and then there's another creature from this book called Deep Woods, which was her favourite book. I'll read you the poem now. The Autumn God. A mist blooms over forest floor, of leaf litter and mould on blighted hoar. And in the pregnant air and twisted leaves comes the smell of smoke from what fire thieves. Is it the incense of a nature god, whose subjects are fur and hooven clod? Is there somewhere yet not in mortal sight, where sits the season's deity with all court and fright? Deep on a throne of twisted trees, gemmed by the dead of summer's bees, sitting laughing at the jests of beasts, awaiting her tribute from the autumn feast.
Thank you, Alexis. Matthew Sweeney.
I come from Donegal, northwest of Ireland. And there's an island up there called Inishrahull, which has not been lived on since 1928. But it was one of the first lighthouses in Ireland. Very strategic for Lough Foyle. The first lighthouse keeper on Inishrahull. I was the first lighthouse keeper on Inishrahull. I switched on the light for the Prince Regent in February 1813. He came in on a flag-fluttering frigate of the Royal Navy and docked at the pier on the east side of the island where the tower rose and where I was now lord of the darkened waves. No ships bound for Derry would now founder on invisible rocks. No uniform was neater than mine. The hundredweights of coal my men carried up those windy stairs to feel the light that dazzled the night would have sufficed to build a coal castle. I have to admit I hardly slept at all that first year. From the beginning we had an argand lamp and a Fresnel lens. There was no better equipped lighthouse down the whole long, stringy coast of Ireland. I was loved by London. They even permitted me to keep a pet seal, contrary to strict regulations. I took to calling the slippery fellow Lumen Mayhem. At 60, I permitted myself to sit down and pen my memoirs. My herb garden was then legendary, was by then legendary, and I'd published the well-received Inishrahull cookbook. My seal was buried in the graveyard. despite objections. My successor had already been appointed. He was a very pale imitation.
Thanks, Matthew. Carolyn Coyle, please.
How you doing? I'm from Athlone, so thanks very much for having me. This poem, I worked with young people, some of them have with a lot of trauma in their lives, and sometimes the words stuck in my head. So the name of this poem is "My Daddy Didn't Hold Me Down." My daddy didn't hold me down. No, he never got me. All the girls were got, but no, not me. I hear them whisper under dark circles of watery arches, and in the sleeve of leaves along the quay. My daddy wasn't fast enough to catch me. My daddy stumbled over quite a lot. He didn't haul his breath upon my cheekbone. His snorting nostrils didn't spit and snot. I didn't smell the sweetness of the cider, or look into his glock commodious eyes. I didn't scream and kick to get him off me. I didn't drown the Shannon with my cries. Street people think that they can see right through me. Narrow eyes from girls and sneers from boys. They rail against the insides of my insides. But everything they heard is all just lies.
Thanks, Carolyn. Grant Murray.
First of all, just to say that Michael O'Callaghan, who shall remain nameless, kind of christened this poem my preacher poem. I tried to do it last week and kind of screwed it up, so I hope you don't mind if I try and do it again.
Can I put that in context? yes, it's a preaching poem, so preach. Where is the preacher? We need more preachers like you, Grant, with something substantial to say.
Well, that remains to be seen. Life is change. We choose that change. It all depends on us. Today, the fabric of our society is under attack. The increase in demands of progress have made our hunger for information turn us into a fast food nation that rips the threads that bind us together, and one by one they snap. We are beginning to experience a new isolation. Care for our society is waning. Our multicultural colors are fading. Our unique identities are paling. Coca-Colaization has left a permanent stain on the dress of our civilization. Today, we live in a world where Google is the new religion that we blindly believe has all the answers, and where the internet gradually kidnaps all our ideas. And it is only a matter of time before the ransom letters start appearing through our letterboxes. We shed private tears from a bleeding heart. Our deepest secret words pass through our fingers like grains of sand. There is no more privacy in this land. Our communication is being bastardized by text message acronyms that rip the soul out of our languages. Our new generation suffers verbal constipation. Consumers bragging about brands bully homemade creativity. Homogeneity is the new king, and he rules with an iron fist that will hammer down any nail that sticks out. Letter writing is now something children marvel at behind the glass cases of museums. Our new communication is limited to an artificial 140 characters, as we witness the digital emasculation of our languages. Soon no one will have the balls to say what they mean, and we use goddamn smileys to show that we're keen. Mutilated messages, devoid of personality, litter our inboxes with misunderstandings. We fall out with friends. There are no soft landings. And we will all live in towers of isolation, princesses whose only communication is done by tap, 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 tapping. We think we know who our friends are, but really we no longer recognize them, for the faces on Facebook are old and our memories have all become cold. Permanently turned on by the vibrations in our pockets, we will find to our cost when the signal is lost that our contacts have become figments of our imagination, and that without that damn phone, we really are all alone. Our children learn to kill on 37-inch screens. They're all wearing headphones, so we can't hear the screams. And our living rooms have really become war zones in which our kids are fighting for their minds. The terms of our existence have become an increasing list of obscure legalese with conditions that we accept with incredible ease, and we sign away our lives with the digital tick of a pen, tick of a pen, tick of a pen. No one really knows all the contracts they're in, and the small print lurks in the shadows. We spend our lives looking through windows that can unexpectedly shut down at any moment. The blue screen of death is the latest disease. How many times must this happen? We have to forget to rely on reset. It's only a machine, but when support is withdrawn, you'll know what I mean. We think a television is for entertainment, but it's not that kind of box. It's the kind of box outside of which we cannot think. The revolution will be televised. And like hungry dogs, we will roam blood-soaked streets from the comfort of our armchairs, watching people die for their beliefs, while we, political eunuchs, watch our politicians play the game of ping-pong blame as we have reduced the Republic of Patriots to a Republic of Telly. A malevolent apathy is our biggest killer. Our minds are blank canvas, always vanilla. We're creatively dead, and the only resurrection is a bullet to the head. Life is change. We choose that change. It all depends on us. Let's choose life.
Mary Noonan, our five-word winner.
Thank you. A couple of weeks ago, I had the very good fortune to spend a week in an artist's retreat. And actually four of the artists who were there with me, three of the artists who were there with me, are here tonight. Dan and Paul Casey and Helen O'Connor. We were all up in the Tyrone Guthrie Centre in County Monaghan. And while we were there, Helen, who is an artist, she was making nettle paper. So I wrote a poem about that and it's dedicated to Helen. Nettle paper. Helen is making nettle paper. We walked the forest path with her to gather the long stalks growing in fat clumps along the lake shore. Cecilia called the names of the hedgerow flowers: tufted vetch, dog violet, meadow sweet, caught sight of a newt, skin. skittering under clover. The quiet of the woodland is deceptive. On straining to listen again, I heard my thoughts, spinning jennies falling through green, and pine needles and cones crackling beneath unseen feet and claws. Then the singing of thin branches swinging on their hinges, pulling against bark. Stretching my ears further, I heard bass notes of a breeze in the ash, sending whispers across the lake, little billows, and a very low hum from the echo chamber of the ancient glacial bowl. In a book, I saw an image of a nettle coat pierced with pins, a garment of shaming. But Helen's nettle paper is see-through, pea-green, a moiré lake's screen, or grasshopper's wings, a mossy cobweb from which she will make lacy forest knickers, panties that unveil umbels and tendrils and silken donkey ears, listening for what's kicking up its heels under the stinging nettle's cover. Thank you.
Thank you, John. I just read an excerpt from my novel. As Hugh O'Connell rightly observed, archaeological work can be get onerous. Therefore, the workers had to make up games to pass the time, like creating a phenomenon known as the Archaeolympics. This comprised of various activities such as synchronized shoveling, how to offload a wheelbarrow spoil onto the spoil heap, fastest trawling and range rod drawing, with John's stern turn to throw a ranging rod across the site. Break washing astonishment. That's the furthest throw I've ever seen. Where is the activation? Better retreat before the wasp gets back. He climbed over the barbed wire bramble fence and, finding his feet, went to grab the ranging rod. Not only did he find the ranging rod, but a very angry farmer loading shotgun. Trespasser, bastard, get off my fucking land! He abandoned the shotgun with intent, and John sprinted over the field, vaulting over the hedge. He looked back to see the farmer, but there was nowhere to be seen. God, that was scary. No more Archaeolympics for me today. He was one angry farmer. I could see him loading his gun and everything. But in fairness, he should have known that I was from the next side, wearing a hard hat and biz vest, and especially that the rod was painted red and white. I wasn't sitting home there or anything. Look, not to worry. He was very pissed off that there was a compulsory poacher's all on his land. It explains why he's protected with what he has left. Still, I give you a 7-foot pole vault and an 8-foot by javelin drawing. Let's play something else. Let's play What Am I? Go on, your turn. Okay. Actually, my grandfather won a medal in Telltown Games. What in? Running and pole vaulting. Rumour had it that the Telltown Games were run for the Olympics. What about medals? There is also the notion that the Ark of the Covenant was buried in Tara, and that the British Israelites hacked the place to bits to find it. Didn't succeed, much less what they did. Well, people are recently in memory almost fucked up archaeologically. Someone bulldozed part of the site of Telltown about 10 years ago, not because some loom marked as a natural gravel bridge on the Ordnance Survey map. There is also the extreme unionist organisation called Tara. Why Tara? Well, the rallying cry is, give us back our 26 counties. They're pretty welcome to them. Whatever about the pole vault, the ranging rod is still on site. The question is, who's going to retrieve it? Not to worry, I'll get it later. Thank you. And I've got it for sale if anyone wants to call me afterwards, okay? Thank you.
Thanks, Patricia. Maria Gillen?
My sister wrote me this poem a few years back when I needed a blessing. So this is Barra by Helen Gillen. Have you seen the blue-shadowed lands of Googon Barra, or felt the creeping silence of its dawn? Night and day visit often in this magic place and bring shadowed garments to cast upon its mountainside. Stone wall sentinels are standing still, reminders of those times in past when Finbar and his people gathered here to pray, to live, to be with God in silence. Silence, the gentle lapping of the lake. Silence, the whispered sound of heartbeat. Silence, the meeting of one soul. Go, traveller, as you have come, in thought or in memory, but leave his footsteps entwined in soft grasses and changing hues of nature. Take with you, though, his breath of prayer, his joy of soul, for this is the shadow of Barra, to fall before and stand behind you always.
Thanks, Maria. Sharon or Shannon O'Neill?
Yeah. It's Sharon, by the way.
Sharon, okay.
Don't you forget it.
I'm making notes.
Sure.
Rather than give you something new this evening, I want to share something very, very old with you. This is a poem that I learnt in fifth class and for some reason has stuck with me for the rest of my life today. It's a poem by Seamus O'Neill, an old Irish poet, and it's the end piece of his collection called Donta Foshti, which is poems for children. It's dedicated to his mother and it's called Suv Millet, which means sweet jam. Bhí Suv Millet ar Vascrún an Doras, ach bhuach mé an Cairí an am a dairí mar, smuining mé ar an lá a bheas an Vascrún glan, agus an láh beag ar Éirí. And it loosely translates as, there was jam on the handle of the door, but I smothered the anger that rose within me because I thought about the day that the door handle would be clean and the small hand missing. Oh, exactly. There are many times that reciting that poem in my head has saved the lives of my children in the last 5 years and from sins far more grievous than a sticky door handle, I can tell you. The other thing about that poem, which I think is the real reason why it stuck with me, is that there is no way that the English translation can translate the incredible lyricism of the expression of a mother's love. So, a minute, ladies and gentlemen.
Thank you, Sharon. Helen O'Connor, please.
Laryngitis. I'll see you, like, you got to whisper, it's way better. Okay, I was at Anne McCarrick with these are the poets, and I actually had an experience of a ghost, or some ghost, so it was going a bit like that in my dreams. Okay. There's an awful lot of doors in Irish houses, keeping out sounds and making their own sounds of creaking and floorboards, creaking cups rattling, and ghosts interfering in the night, bringing news of the unconscious, doubts and fears, the child crying in the dark woods, the strange man whispering in your ear, and darkness, rain.
Thank you. baby and laryngitis. He must have picked something up in that retreat. Mary O'Connell.
Well, it's very fortuitous that I too have a poem about a ghost after Helen, but it's a sad poem. It's really about my brother, who at one stage played Von Rothbart in Swan Lake, and it's called Ghost in the Machine. Late into the night, I watch a program taped a week ago while I was in Spain. The grainy black and white of 1972 flickers on the screen. A studio in Emmett Place, camera pans on Corps de Ballet, zooms in on Joan Denise, cuts to a scene on stage. Without warning, you come into view. Fierce in your swirling cloak, you carry off the grieving swan. I freeze the frame, remembering the way life had stopped for you, though barely 42. All that promise gone, poise, flare, on hold.
Cedric, what's your second name again?
Your second name, Mikael.
Yeah.
You
should put it down on the list so I can read it.
Yeah,
it's not necessary.
Well, it's just a response to something I heard earlier. In culture, we find homogeneity all through an agreed pattern. Do we remain happy to be all the same? In the lack of thereof, we find chaos, or without anything but greed for pattern. May we remain happy, knowing no shame? Equilibrium is a fine line nobody walks for long. Watch the word pendulum, it oscillate, and pray you were not wrong. So that was for the first one. And the second one is about consciousness. A few thousand pulse flare through the net. Something has reached him. It is safe to breathe. The same amount of something flows out. As the net works, pulses some more. What uses reflexes does not self-reflect. Yet, can you say that the thing does not think? Where is it exactly that the bird of consciousness? What is consciousness? Where does it lie? What is its truth? To all the structural friction between matters, is it truth? Another gentle quake shakes the net, but somewhere does not bounce back. Something has slipped in, made a crack. The strobe went forward and changed. In its wake, things fed on the noise it ingrained. A new layer of process is established through the era of evolution, itself revolving around the mechanics of chemical production. What is consciousness? Still no answer. Maybe a hint of its makeover. It is a vast yet closed space. All of the universe's mass. On seemingly complicated interactions, holding neither sense of chaos or nor progress, lies the beginning and the end of all events. What is consciousness?
Deirdre O'Brien.
Okay, so this poem is called Maximum Load, and if you've ever gone to over to France and back on the ferry, you notice how it's all about loading up for a safe crossing. So, maximum load. It's easier when you know the maximum load. The ferry could only take on board 2,400 passengers, 650 cars, and then a few dogs and kennels on deck number 10. It's easier when you know the weight. The heaviest trucks were first out the gate. Then all the vans, camper vans, caravans. We had loaded the car with our vans too, Grand Rouge, Grand Blanc. It's easier when you know the capacity, the maximum. But you don't know that until one day there is a strain, an uneven weight. You sail on uneasily or stop for a while, take some load off, and make some repairs. This is no failing on a night's troubled road. You just exceeded the maximum.